Let the son of a gun run.
All right, now you start.
Yeah, if you don't, the damn thing will quit again on you. I mentioned a manager of a government and I discussing, or I was trying to promote another rat farm west of my project. Honorable John Bracken decided that they would go ahead, and they gathered up $100,000. Arthur McNamara, Public Works, and Honorable T.R. Creer in Ottawa, and they started in 1936. I worked for them for a couple of months, along with Don Denmark. Don Denmark is a Dominion land surveyor in charge of the Hudson's Bay Company's Rat Ranch at the Cumberland House right now. He got the idea from down here. Well, the government's project worked out very favorably and very well. They increased the rats enormously, the rats total, taking off a couple of hundred thousand, where there was 75,000 taken before, and so on and so forth. So that's gone on very good. But this last number of years, the rats have sadly declined. I don't know what the future holds for us, but there'll be something else prop up. Like David Copperfield said, there's always something around the next corner. Now, to go back to the fish haul days, Lee, you said something about our hardest work, hard times. Well, they were really bad. That was hell on earth in those days with the horses. I felt so sorry for the horses. I thought if they could only discover, I've mentioned many times my brothers, Eric and Laddie, could discover some kind of a machine that would go over the snow, that would take the place of these poor horses that are played out and thin, and sore shoulders, red raw from their collars, frozen collars at night. So we're very, very glad to see the evolution of the Caterpillar tractor. And that's just about the fastest thing there is on the ground up north is the Caterpillar. These bombardiers and snow buggies and swamp buggies and all the rest of their weasels and beeps and jeeps. The Caterpillar tractor's got them all beat for loads, and no snowdrift can stop them. So it is a mighty nice thing in the early 30s when we started taking out these Caterpillar tractors such as they were, and then gradually get rid of all the horses. In the old days, just take a trip from Moose Lake over to Pickerel Channel and the East Arm into William Lake and Davidson Lake and back over to Egg Lake and then over to north end of Moose Lake and into the Steel and then back to the Paw. That's a 21-day trip. 21-day trip without changing your underwear. You get pretty lousy at the end of the trip. No grub, moose meat, fish. Frozen bannock eaters is the name we had. And mother used to, and the Indian women, mother would get them to make bannock by the ton almost. Lots of tallow in it, it wouldn't freeze so hard. And we put these bannocks in gunny sacks. And then she'd boil beans, very few canned goods in those days. Boil beans and big pots of beans and put them in shallow pans about an inch deep and then freeze them, put them out in the evening and night, and they're frozen in 10 minutes. Then smash them up with a hammer and put them in gunny sacks. Beans and chopped up pork. Then in the noon, you just breakfast or supper, throw them into the frying pan, and you got a good pan. And she used to do the same thing with plum duff, plum pudding. Great big plum pudding, slice it, just like bologna. And we used to fry that plum pudding. And the same thing with the apples, and boiled up apples, and then chopped them up in squares, frozen, and everything was frozen, of course, along the road. But we'd start off, our dad would start us off with maybe 15 or 20 teams of horses. And there's just Eric and I, that's three white boys, that's all the white people there were in this country. And the rest would be all Indians. the driving team, and they were as green as grass, but they're tough, and they could sleep outside and live on nothing, and never have any frozen feet or any trouble with them. Good in the bush, and we'd start off, and the first night would be possibly Prickle Channel, and take your team up, and every man had his own team, which along went with it a pair of horse blankets, which would be just like a board, it'd be until they thawed out around the horse, because the steam off the horse would freeze them. A water pail, and a lantern, and an axe, and that's your equipment, plus the grub box for maybe 8 men or 6 men, and the next 6 men, and so on. And then we'd also carry horseshoe nails, horseshoe hammers, and little stuff like that, brace and bit, 4-inch spike for the sleighs and racks, and the snowplow. No acetylene outfit in those days, or electric welding. Wouldn't acetylene tank be a dandy thing to have along when we break all those brace and radius rods? And well, anyway, we'd keep on mooching along, and for 21 days, we'd have to have about 25 or 30 bales of hay per team on top of your load. But we were going out empty, and for 21 days, we'd need, for one team always, need 15 bags of oats. We would just throw the, dig a hole, shove a, and drop the tongue at noon and kick the snow away, make a hollow in the snow and pour in 2 gallons of oats. Feed them all they could eat for heat.
Tom, what happened if you had a blizzard and got stuck somewhere?
Well, when the blizzard came along, we'd just go around in a circle and kind of keep together. Many of the time we stopped out in the middle of the lake, we couldn't go 30 yards. It would make a great big circle and put the horses behind the sleighs. And there would be, that's all. We'd carry wood on top, on the big lakes, we'd carry wood on top of the sleighs, and then make a fire on the ice. And then carry on, and then you hit a portage, you'd be well away there with a big storm. We don't mind when the portage is, you can always travel. And then you'd have to take the snowplow off in front, and 6 or 7 men lift it on the back of a rack for the portages. And then you come to the next lake, you take the snowplow off, throw it in on the ice, and put your push poles on, which went over your tongues of your sleighs. And there'd be 4 teams of horses pushing the plow. You'd have a glare of ice.
But did you ever run out of food for your horses?
Oh, sure, that's bad. Well, there were tough rations. When you got to reduce their hay and their oats, it's terrible. Whenever they get to, say, William Lake, now we'd have 3 trips across the 9-mile portage over to Moose Lake to make 1 load for yourself, because you could haul a third on the portage. When you got to the glare ice, you'd take 110 boxes. About 35 boxes to a load in the portages, and you'd take 105, 110 boxes in the glare ice. Would make 3 trips at 3 days, back and forth, with these 150-pound, 160, up to 200-pound boxes of frozen fish. Then you'd deck them up 2 and 3 high, and clean away the snow to make little Ys into the main track. I'd plow alongside the whole line of them, and then they'd make their Ys into the track, and away we'd come. And start them with a pinch bar, and then there's no pull at all on the glare ice. But once you stop, you have a heck of a time starting again. And travel on and on. Oh, my gosh. I come at night, make a great big circle in that green timber along some little bay where it's sheltered, and everybody head for the bush with their horses. Dig away the snow, carry up bales of hay in your back, and then make a place for yourself to sleep. Dig away the snow, cut down the spruce boughs, get the frying pan out, tea kettle.
How cold would it be on an average in these days?
Well, it is. I've seen a 61 below many times. 55, 40, 50. And the worst weather is when it's about 25 below and about a 35 or 40 mile hour wind. That's when the horses' noses, they're just icicles hanging down, and it's awful. Terribly cold, and then you also for yourself, especially riding the plow, your face, my nose is frozen from December to end of March, and your cheeks, you peel off all the time. Terribly cold. Of course, that's what we wanted, to make ice. And then when it come to these cracks in the ice, there's another delay. We'd have to all get the big scoop shovels out and axes and ice chisels and chop down these big ice heaves. Where the cracks run across the lake, they'd be maybe 10, 12 feet high where the ice is pushed up like a pinnacle. Chop all that down and then fill the main crack down underneath the snow. It'll be a wide open space, maybe 2 feet wide. You can't, it's camouflaged over with snow, but if you got to fill all that up with the chunks of ice to get your teams across. That's what.
Wait for it to freeze?
No. Just pack it down, fill that crack full, and then get your team on the dead run and jump over, get over it. You're generally upset there because it's rough way of packing the ice. That's where a lot of these boys are drowned. The tractor trains, they don't take enough time. Sometimes they have to go 25, 30 miles out of our road with the tractor train nowadays to get around the ice cracks. Whereas you hit the shore, you have to go up in the bush and get around it. We dropped 6 cats through 1 winter. I've dived down for them quite a few times, get a diving suit and salvage the tractor at the bottom of the lake, put cables on it and chains and tripods, and then raise them up.
But you did that in the spring after the...
Well, in the winter, if you... Well, we often carry a cable dragging way behind. And when the tractor goes through that cable, you have a 100-foot cable, and it's only 25, 30 feet of water. You have some cable left over there, and you pull that up, and there's your cat down in the end of the cable. So you've got something to work with.
Is that a boat coming?
They got it. Yeah. When the cat tractors came on the market, they were a great thing for us up here. We had to cut our trails wider, and we could go where the make a 3-day trip with horses. You do it in one with a cat. That's what brought us into going further afield. Into South Indian Lake and Nelson House country, cutting roads. But then the market was always very unpredictable. When we started off in the fall, a big expense. I never know what we're going to get for our fish. It's pretty risky business all the way through. But my dear dad and mother would always give us great encouragement by telling us to keep going, and when you get slapped down, it's just to see what kind of stuff is in you. She used to tell us boys. So we just have to go, that's all, and get there the best way we can. And break a runner, whether you go to the bush and cut down a birch tree and Dan will put a runner or a tongue in the sleigh and repair your outfit and keep on going.
Well, what about the worst years? Where would you place
them? Well, the worst years, I think, are around 28, 29, 30, 31, 32. In those years, the Depression was also... But we had one redeeming feature. One thing was the price of Red Fox were pretty good. That helped us along, and weasels. But there are very few muskrats, so that's what led us into this rat farm business, to try and cultivate and grow our own. And that we call it the Hungry 30s, or the Bennett Buggy Days. In the Hungry 30s and 29s, men are only $1 a day. very glad to get that. So that is the days that we did a lot of work on our rat ranch, 31, 32. It is pretty tough going. But everybody got enough to eat and wear and kept warm in the wintertime somewhere or other. We all got by.
It was a big gamble, though, the rat farm, wasn't it?
Oh, yes. Well, everything's a gamble in the north. It doesn't matter what you tackle, you know.
How much did you put in before you took anything out?
Well, we spent 3 years working at it. I know I owed $25,000 in the little town of the Paw with the Western Grocers and Marshall Wells and the oil people and the flour people. And they kept, every year I'd go and run my face for some more credit and kept telling them that they were improving and they're, I'd say, why don't you kill some? Why don't you, same as these cattle. People say, why don't you kill them? Well, we got to wait. We got to get a start. We got to build our herd up. And same with our rats and beaver. We didn't want to do it. There's money in the bank, and the more we left, the more we take off eventually. So when we got our big paycheck the first year, around $70,000, I just went around and paid up the way I borrowed, all up and down the streets, and paid the bank manager and the lumber company and flower people. So there's a good old, you really don't know your friends until you get hired up. And tight. You don't know your friends until you're hired up, and then you know what kind of people you're dealing with. It's easy as long as you got you're flush and lots of money. Everything goes fine, but when you get right down and you want $50,000 credit, you can tell which are the best wholesalers.
That's right, too. Now, in the meantime, did you try any prospecting ventures?
Well, I was never lucky in prospecting. I spent a lot of money. I made a few dollars in the early days, but not big money. And we're always, I was kind of unlucky in prospecting. But then since 1933-34, we started to fly. We couldn't very well stake claim because we're flying out so many mining people, and we wouldn't want to jump their claims.
Yeah. Well, what kind of prospecting ventures did you try?
Well, staking claims up north and dynamiting iron dikes and peridotite dikes, copper showings, little nickel showings. Because nickel was no good in those days. Everybody's after gold. I had a few. We made a little bit of money, but there's more. We spent more money than we ever made out of prospecting, and we've more or less kept away from it. That kind of having our 10 airplanes going, and we wouldn't want to encroach on international nickel and these people that have finds that we know are good, and we do the flying for them. So we either got to prospect or stake claims, or go to the airplane business, or stay in the airplane business, and quit monkeying around staking claims, interfering with people. So we just strictly leave that strictly. None of the boys have a prospecting license. That's nice.
Yeah, a little close. A little further up. Now, didn't you once have a near miss? A big miss?
Oh, yeah. We've had a few just around the corner, you know. Yeah.
What was the one that you were telling me about the other day? I'd like to hear about that.
Well, not very many years ago, I found a big peridotite dike up northwest of Flin Flon. So this Dick Scheller and I went in on it. He's a mining engineer in Winnipeg, a very fine chap, Dick Scheller.
How do you spell his name?
S-H-A-L-L-A-R, Scheller. Mm-hmm. Dick Scheller. So we go 50-50 on things like that. I flew in with him and we took a grub stake and some dimethylglyoxine, which is a little white powder to put on rock. It shows up nickel very well if there's any nickel in it. Anyway, it looked very good. The samples were brought out and we made a deal with International Nickel for $350,000. And all this contract signed up, and then we're getting $400 a month to keep the grocery man quiet while they were developing it. But the more acids that they sent away and the more they went into it, they found that it just contained too much sulfur. So the whole thing fell through. But as Greg says, it was a hell of a good mine while it lasted. We were pretty happy there for a month or so until it went down. But that the day will come when that property can be worked, I suppose, when they devise a way of extracting the sulfur.
Any other exceptional things like that, or was that the best one?
No, we've had other ones. I spent a lot of money down east here, or towards God's Lake, Stevenson Lake. That's away from, and then over in Ontario, in the Cobham River, we've had big chunks of...
For what was that?
Galena, silver lead. It's just the teasers they are, you know. So someday, when we get time, we'll take some geologists down there, and they'll give us a good reading on it. They seem to be able to look down further into the rock than I can. You can shut it off.
Yes.
You're asking about interesting trips in the north. Well, we've had some. Dr. Ewell, my very good friend, who was Indian Department doctor in Nepal for some 18 years.
What's his first name?
Dr. Robert Ewell. He's a great old man. I shouldn't call him old. He's retired now. I guess he's 70. But we've had an awful lot of fun with him. He's quite a character and a pretty good traveler up north. 1938, I guess, or 39, I forget. The Dominion government wanted him to go up north and feed a bunch of starving Eskimo. This is in January, they'd missed the caribou. So reports came down from dog team, from Anadaya and Poor Fish, Knowlton Lake country, down into Brushy, and then from Brushy it is radioed out to the Paw, or through Edmonton, around to the Paw. That a lot of these Eskimo, there were 60 of them, died there in one winter. So Ewell came to me, and we organized a party, organized a bunch to get going. I had gas cached up north, got grub and rifle shells, ammunition, flour, sugar, tea, and so on and so forth. And away we went up to Brushy. From there we had to go further north for days, and storm bound, sleeping in the bush, and had more fun than a picnic with old Doc. And when we found the first bunch of Eskimo, they're in the doggone little igloos, dirty, starving, living off of caribou bones. I remember caribou bones, and they were even taking the hair off of their hides and then boiling and chewing the hides just for some nourishment out of the skin. That night, camping in this igloo with my mechanic, Alfie Noakes, the old lady comes around with an old pot, and you just before you go to bed, and she passes it around from one to another, and Doc was a little bit self-conscious. He just couldn't do anything, and he hummed and hawed and crabbed, and everybody was kidding him, of course. So sure enough, that night about 10 o'clock, the old man has to get up, and he goes out and nearly kills two or three pups with steps on their neck and trying to find the hole out of the igloo. So, however, the following summer, we went up again to count them and give them names and give them medallions with a number on their neck with these medals that they issue, 1546 and so and so. So we had a lovely trip that time. Found these Eskimo. We had 150 pound of tea with us, for one thing, and our old trusty Norseman, BHS, the best old airplane that ever hit the north.
What's that called?
BHS, that's the registration letter, CFBHS, a Norseman. Mm-hmm. A beautiful evening up there. We all, a dock went fishing, and along with the Eskimo. So I went over to cook some trout, and I used an old Indian kettle they had there, and when Doc saw me using that with these boiled trout in there, he nearly had a cat fit. He remembered the pail that he used last winter. So went in, we had a pretty good time taking their names and checking over their teeth and one thing and another. and put them on a proper list so the Ottawa knew what they had. Then the following year they went up and gave them treaty. But it's quite a wild country up there, and no maps in those days. We just have to ask one Eskimo onto another camp and one to another camp, and they'd be hundreds of miles apart.
How far north of Churchill?
Well, it's west, northwest of Churchill. It's about 400 miles north and west. Went down the Kazan River. But it's a country that I like up there. It's new. Whenever you land in a lake, you may say that this is the only airplane, this first airplane that's ever landed there. And you see signs of Eskimos, 300 and 400 years old, with the stones around in a circle, moss all grown on them, and they've been holding down their tents. And you find old axe heads and copper kettles and stuff like that. They move about, they're nomadic, they follow the deer. I'm going up next month.
What happened with Doc Yule up there?
Hello, poor Doc. He doesn't know north, east, south, and west, but he just travels along and he trains himself to go to sleep in the plane. Yeah.
I better. Yeah.
Well, I wish I could train myself like Dr. Yule. He can just step into an airplane and throw back his head and he's sound asleep, which is it's a wonderful thing for a man to do. He doesn't smoke, drink, or neck. He's a pretty good living fella. When we're down that Kazan River, I landed there at the place called the River of the Graves. Some fever or something hit them one year, and there's an awful lot of graves down there. Dr. Brandt, who was in the paw, he's a dolphin now, wanted to bring him back a skull. So I stopped at my old friend Kekuk, used to be an Eskimo chief up there. He was dead for 2 or 3 years. So I stopped and twisted off his head. Well, quite well preserved. They're wrapped up in caribou hides.
What was his name?
Kekuk. K-A-K-O-O-K, I guess. Kekuk. Old Kekuk. All his belongings there piled up on top of him, just a few stones around him. So it's frozen 12 months of the year, permafrost. So when I brought his little axes out and leather drills or bow drills and all Eskimo stuff, Eskimo knives, tanning things that he tans hides with and so on, Doc bummed me for his head. Well, I didn't want to give it to him. I wanted to give it to Dr. Brandt. When I got to the paw and I cleaned it up a little bit, it didn't stink so much. Finally, I gave it to the old man, and he takes it home.
Dr. Yule?
Dr. Yule, yeah, and his wife wasn't in. He puts it in a pot to boil it and puts it in the stove to clean it up. And then he had a hurried call to the hospital, and when Mrs. Yule came, there was some ladies, this terrible stink in the house. She said, oh, my gosh, my gosh. And she messes around, couldn't find anything. She goes over to the stove, lifts the lid off the pot, and here's old Kekuk looking at her. So, that poor old you. Three or four years ago, there was a funny disease going around at a place called Shamattawa. S-C-H-A-M-A-T-A-W-A, Shamattawa, where the great river comes in. There's the God's River and Shamattawa. The boys and I had quite a time flying these men and women and children and girls out to the paw and then on through to Winnipeg. They examined by clever doctors to find out what the thing was. Some said it's just mass hysteria, and some said they wanted to trip out, but they were certainly completely crazy. No Indians, Shamattawa Indians, and real dangerous. Doc Yule had his hands full up there. While we're tying one up in the plane, we'd bring him down on stretchers and tie their hands and feet with rope. And while he's bending over one, a young girl reached over and grabbed him with her teeth in the seat of the pants and took a chunk right out of the backside of old Doc Yule.
Oh, no.
Yeah. I brought him down to the pond and flew the mites in through into Winnipeg, the special nurses. But that is an awful affair there. Yeah, they gradually got over it. It might have been bad whiskey or stuff that they were drinking or poisoned with something, but it cost the government many thousands of dollars to bring these crazy Indians out, and I don't know whether they gradually all got better.
How many did you carry at a time?
Well, we hold 9 in the plane, but I had 7 adults and 3 or 4 small girls. We had some very clever nurses in the department sent up from Winnipeg. They accompanied them down. They were pretty good. They'd slap them down with a slap of the hand, some of them, which led me to believe that they weren't altogether crazy. Some of the young girls, they were just screaming and yelling and foaming at the mouth and
making noise while you were flying?
Oh my, terrible. And I felt sorry for them. And some of the men would bit the end of the belts. So we took all the seats out and laid them on the floor, but the belts were tied to the floor of the airplane, you know. And they'd pick up that belt and bite it, and they'd break their front teeth. That's how hard they were biting. It's much less.
That's it.